Negotiations continue in Washington as the U.S. inches closer to a deadline to raise its debt limit and avoid its first ever default.
It would wipe out millions of jobs, up to 8 million jobs. It would trigger a recession. It would devastate retirement accounts. It would increase costs. It would damage our international reputation.
Plus, remembering rock legend, icon, domestic abuse survivor Tina Turner, who rose to become one of the top recording artists of all time. And a sober one-year anniversary of one of the deadliest school shootings in U.S. history. Today is Thursday, May 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Families and loved ones mourned the unimaginable loss of 19 children and two teachers, shot dead 1 year ago in Uvalde, Texas, in what was the nation's deadliest school shooting in a decade. The town held a private ceremony and candlelight vigil to mark the somber anniversary. At the White House, President Joe Biden said it's time to act on gun control.
Standing there in Uvalde, Jill and I couldn't help but think that too many schools, too many everyday places have become killing fields in communities all across every part of America. And in each place, we hear the same message. Do something. For God's sake, please do something.
He noted the epidemic of gun violence has become the number one killer of kids in America. So far this year, more than 670 teenagers and children in the U.S. have been killed in gun-related violence, according to the Gun Violence Archive, an independent data collection group. Karina Bafrajian tells us about a Washington, D.C. mother and Army veteran working with communities to tackle the problem.
Juwanna Hardy is an Army veteran, a mother, and a Washington, D.C. native. She says she watched gun-related deaths rise in the U.S. and in 2018 decided to organize Guns Down Friday, a group dedicated to reducing gun violence.
The streets of D.C. was worse than a war zone, and I just truly wanted to create change. It's scary. It's scary to just, you know, you teach your children to stay away from certain people, to do this, everything to protect yourselves, but with these mass shootings, it's like, what can you do?
Every Friday, Hardy drives to Washington neighborhoods with higher rates of gun-related incidents, meeting with children and families to find ways to reduce violence and help residents heal. The group provides resources and programs to help those affected by youth homicides, suicides, and mental health problems. Hardy says the group also works with city authorities on other things, like installing street lamps in darker parts of neighborhoods.
A neighborhood that we went into, we noticed that shooters were coming behind bushes. They would come and shoot behind these bushes. So we asked the kids, what can you do to end gun violence in your community? They said, we can cut the bushes so we can see what's going on. So, you know, we rallied up. We actually got the council member to come to the neighborhood and cut those bushes.
13-year-old Makai King Brooks is a volunteer who says he himself has been exposed to shootings.
I was still like real young, so I put up my curtains all in my room. I didn't want nobody going near my window. I didn't want to vacuum my room because that was too loud. I don't know. I was real paranoid.
13-year-old Rashad Bates lost a good friend a few years ago to gun violence. He says meeting and talking with Hardy helps him cope.
I feel like angry and sad at the same time. If I get emotional, Ms. Hardy, she'd be right there to talk me out of it.
Child psychologists say even reading or watching news about gun violence can severely affect children's health and cause mood swings, sleep disruption, loss of appetite, and problems with concentration. But they stress often families can prevent these symptoms from turning into more serious psychological issues like severe anxiety and depression.
Parents talking to their children about things that happen can be very helpful. You're watching a movie together and there's a shooting. You know, that's an opportunity to casually engage your child in conversation, you know, your teenager or your school age child. What would that be like? How would you handle that? Here's, wow, that would make me feel sad. What about you?
According to Gun Violence Archive, over 670 children and teens have died as a result of gun violence in the U.S. through May 17 of 2023. Karina Befradjian for VOA News, Washington.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he remains optimistic the two sides can make a deal as the nation approaches a debt default as soon as next week. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
McCarthy says he's sending his negotiators back here to the White House in hopes of finishing out debt limit talks. But
there's a number of places that we are still far apart.
Put simply,
we have to spend less than we spent last year.
Democrats are willing to freeze spending, not cut it. As the impasse continues, Treasury Chief Janet Yellen tells the WSJ CEO Council Summit that without a deal to boost the debt limit, it seems nearly certain the U.S. will run out of cash to pay its bills in early June.
Possibly as early as June 1st.
Saying the standoff's already roiling financial markets and threatening the global economy. Sagar Magani at the White House.
The leader of the Wagner militia group, which is aiding Russia in its war on Ukraine, says thousands of his troops died in the battle for Bakhmut. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma has the story.
Wagner's chief says his force has lost more than 20,000 soldiers in the drawn-out battle for Bakhmut, with about 20% of the 50,000 Russian convicts he recruited to fight in the 15-month war dying in the eastern Ukrainian city. The figure's in stark contrast with claims from Moscow that it's lost just over 6,000 troops in the war. It's also higher than the official estimate of the Soviet losses in the Afghanistan war of 15,000 troops between 1979 and 1989. The Ukrainian General Staff says that heavy fighting is continuing inside Bakhmut, days after Russia said it's completely captured the devastated city. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Meanwhile, NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, speaking at the German Marshall Fund Brussels Forum Wednesday, said Russian President Vladimir Putin has made two big strategic mistakes in his war on Ukraine.
One was to underestimate the Ukrainians. The bravery, the resolve, the courage of the Ukrainian people. And they've been able to push back the Ukrainians from the north around Kiev, the east Kharkiv, and the south around Kherson. But they also totally underestimated us, NATO allies and partners.
Stoltenberg also stressed that the need for close ties with European allies must continue, noting Russia should not be underestimated. Residents reported that clashes between rival military factions could be heard overnight in parts of Sudan's capital on the second full day of a week-long ceasefire designed to allow for the delivery of aid and lay the ground for a more lasting truce. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is moving tens of thousands of Sudanese refugees in Chad away from the Sudan border and into new camps. The UNHCR's visiting deputy says concerns about security and access to aid are increasing, along with the number of refugees. Henry Wilkins reports from the Gaga refugee site in Chad.
Around 150 Sudanese refugees who just arrived in the town of Adra in Chad await transport to their new home, a refugee site 100 kilometres away from the Chad-Sudan border. Under the cover of darkness, Zahra Haroun Adam fled from West Darfur with her children 3 days ago.
Around 10 at night, we all escaped the fighting. Some of us went north and the others went south. We were divided, so I came here. People here welcomed us and provided us with food.
Marwa Adam Dawood Hamid, another Sudanese refugee, says she found leaving her country difficult and she worries about the future.
Of course, we will receive help at first and a welcome too, but then you're the one who is responsible for yourself beyond that. I'm talking about where we will live, how we will get clothes to wear. Healthcare too is important.
The refugees climb onto trucks in Adra, not knowing what awaits them. But it can only be better than staying in Sudan or this impoverished town, which has little to offer strangers. After enduring a grueling journey along dirt roads, they arrive at their destination, the Gargo refugee site, late at night. The following day, Rauf Mazou, Assistant High Commissioner for Operations at UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, visits Gargo. He explains why refugees must be moved away from the border quickly.
No, we are relocating refugees because it has been agreed that for security reasons, it is difficult for them to stay along the border. And secondly, for reasons of providing the support and assistance that they require.
On Tuesday, May 23rd, the Red Cross warned of a humanitarian disaster on the Chad-Sudan border, as more refugees than expected have fled into Chad since Sudan's civil war started. With the rainy season approaching, promising to make transporting aid over dirt roads more difficult, and violence likely to spill over into Chad, UNHCR is unlikely to have the means to move all the refugees away from the border in time. The Gargo refugee site has existed since Darfur's 2003 war. UNHCR says it's adding capacity for 10,000 new arrivals and intends to build a new camp nearby. Whether the 60,000 remaining refugees who have fled Sudan since its civil war started will find safe shelter is uncertain. Hamad says she has no desire to stay in Gargo.
The situation is horrible. I can't tell you. I'm not planning to stay here. I know that we need help, but we're planning to go back as soon as possible.
UNHCR says it's not expecting the situation in Sudan to improve soon, and aid groups complain of a critical lack of funding to assist refugees in Chad. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Gargo, Chad.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs hosted a high-level pledging conference Wednesday to support Horn of Africa countries enduring years of drought. The conference yielded $2.4 billion in pledges, which UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said was urgently needed to help fund aid operations to assist more than 30 million people across Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia.
Crisis atop of crisis is threatening the lives and livelihoods of millions across the Horn of Africa. The longest drought on record. Mass displacement after years of conflict and insecurity. Skyrocketing food prices. And now chaos and fighting have engulfed Sudan, radiating instability across the entire region.
The UN describes the Horn of Africa as the epicenter of one of the world's worst climate emergencies. We're following these other stories from around the world. Powerful Typhoon Mawar churned slowly over the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam on Thursday, lashing the island with wind and rain, tearing down trees, walls, and power lines, flipping cars, and pushing dangerous storm surge ashore. The typhoon, the strongest to hit the U.S. territory, briefly made landfall Wednesday night as a Category 4 storm with maximum sustained winds of 225 kilometers per hour. Months after banning Afghan women from work for the United Nations and other aid agencies, Taliban authorities have told aid workers that new guidelines allowing women to return to humanitarian work are almost complete. And the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is urging Iran to decriminalize mandatory veiling laws, warning that the harassment of women, including what they do or do not wear, appears to have intensified as street protests have died down. This is VOA News.
Brazilian ecologists are leading an ambitious project in the Amazon to preserve the world's largest tropical forest by managing a stretch of land that welcomes local communities and scientists alike. The initiative aims to counter the forces that have caused significant deforestation in the region, serve as a replicable model for other parts of the Amazon. By establishing the nonprofit Jurua Institute and purchasing rainforest property along the Jurua River, the project says it promotes sustainable practices such as controlled fishing, the prized pararucu, without resorting to forest clearance. The Institute also involves adjacent river communities through public meetings and prioritizes their needs, fostering collaboration between traditional knowledge and scientific approaches. The project's success could inspire similar conservation efforts across the Amazon region, empowering local communities while protecting the environment. I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Israel and Africa are deepening their already close ties with Israeli technology aiming to help Africa deal with its growing population. African officials recently visited Israel to discuss more cooperation. Linda Gradstein brings us this story from Jerusalem.
The Mitrelli Group, a Swiss company that employs Israeli technology in Africa, marked its 10th anniversary by bringing officials from six African countries to Jerusalem. Mitrelli's founder, CEO, and many of its staff are Israeli, and they say that Israeli innovation can move Africa forward. Chaim Taib, the founder and president of the Mitrelli Group, says the company has already opened 200 vocational schools across Africa and plans to build more.
In the next decade, we will train 1 million people to work in technology and innovation in Africa. I took models from Israel and brought them to Africa. And now, after 30 years, I want to bring what I learned in Africa back to Israel.
Israel is known for its large number of startups, and visiting African officials from countries like Senegal are interested in importing Israeli agricultural technology. Serene Gaya is an advisor to the president of Senegal.
The main issue was food shortage, rice production, vegetable production, milk and meat production. We used to import all these items from different countries because we couldn't simply, the existing technique of in agriculture, produce enough food. So that's why our government, under the leadership of the President Macky Sall, has decided now to collaborate with Israeli government and Israeli private sector.
An official from Ivory Coast said his government plans to invest $1 billion over the next 5 years to grow the country's economy. Valahi Mete is the Director General of Economic Diplomacy in Ivory Coast.
Cote d'Ivoire is also a developing country. We need a lot of infrastructure investment in power. We need infrastructure investment in water and sanitation. We need investment in road construction. So that's why we are here for. And we know that Israel has developed such a very high level of expertise. So we want to take advantage of that.
The ties between Israel and Africa are politically valuable for Israel, which often faces criticism in international bodies like the UN. Ido Moed is the head of the Africa Department at the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Israel has diplomatic relations with 44 sub-Saharan countries. And, of course, when it comes to the United Nations, every vote and every voice counts. However, African countries are not, we don't see African countries as one big group. Each country is different. Each country has different interests and ideas.
The population of Africa is expected to grow to 2.5 billion people in the next 30 years. The Mitrelli Group says Israeli technology can help African states not only meet their population's needs, but also flourish at the same time. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
In the United States, May is a month to celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander heritage. Genia DeLo takes us to a celebration in California.
At San Diego's Balboa Park, Korean Americans perform pongmul, a traditional Korean art form that includes drumming and dancing that originated with Korean farmers celebrating their harvest. Ocean Park is a first-generation Korean American.
I'm very grateful for my family having introduced me to this Korean drumming, just because I feel like that has really helped me kind of stay in touch with my Korean identity. And definitely, I think thanks to this group and this organization, I am definitely more connected to my tradition, more so than any other Korean Americans.
This celebration of Asian Pacific American Heritage Month takes place at the Park's House of Pacific Relations, which is made up of cottages representing 31 countries. The House of China is one of the oldest here, founded in 1935, and presents a traditional lion dance and Chinese calligraphy. Wei Wei Schwartz is a member of the House of China.
Usually, Americans, you know, non-Chinese language people, they don't understand anything. Oh, Chinese is so difficult. But if you know, give the people the key to understand, it's easier.
Celebrations here also featured performances of Indian, Japanese, Filipino, Vietnamese, and Hawaiian heritage. House of Pacific Relations President Inki Welsh says it is an opportunity to share culture.
So just bring about what makes us a group the way we are, and then learn about the ancestry, ethnicity, and then to celebrate just, you know, living in the United States.
Welsh says the festival helps raise public awareness about the diverse and distinct cultures among Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, and Native Hawaiians. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, San Diego, California.
Tina Turner, the unstoppable singer and stage performer who was among the first celebrities to speak candidly about domestic abuse, becoming a symbol of resilience, has died at the age of 83. Associated Press correspondent Margie Zarzaleta reports.
Tina Turner's life was a roller coaster. Hit songs in the 1960s, leaving an abusive marriage, becoming a superstar in her 40s, and having her life turned into a hit movie. She recorded songs like Proud Mary, Nutbush City Limits, and River Deep Mountain High with her ex-husband Ike Turner. Turner's first solo album flopped. Then she released Private Dancer and her career was bigger than ever. Angela Bassett played her in the film What's Love Got to Do With It. Turner said in a 1993 AP interview she instructed Bassett that the dancing should be energetic, not raunchy.
She appreciated that as well because she was a few times going to the front. No, not from the front, always to the side.
I'm Margie Zarzaleta.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The short-term ceasefire in Sudan to allow for humanitarian aid has raised hopes that the fighting between warring security forces loyal to two rival generals could be brought to an end. The violence of the last several weeks has resulted in thousands of deaths. Additionally, some 840,000 people have been displaced within Sudan, and another 250,000 have been forced to flee the country. In a message to the Sudanese people, Secretary of State Antony Blinken called the violence senseless and devastating.
The whole world has been united in calling for an end to this conflict and insisting on a negotiated solution.
The short-term ceasefire that went into effect May 22nd was arranged to allow for humanitarian assistance and repair of essential services and infrastructure. It was the result of intensive diplomacy by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United States. A remote mechanism backed by the United States is used to monitor the ceasefire. If the ceasefire is violated, we'll know and we will hold violators accountable through sanctions and other means, said Secretary Blinken.
We facilitated the ceasefire, but it's the responsibility of the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces to implement it.
The United States remains the largest single donor of humanitarian aid to Sudan and, on May 23rd, announced $245 million in additional support to the people of Sudan and neighboring countries experiencing the impacts of the ongoing humanitarian crisis. In his message to the Sudanese people, Secretary of State Blinken emphasized that Sudan civilians must be the ones to define Sudan's path going forward.
You should lead a political process to restore Sudan's democratic transition and form a civilian government. Sudan's political future belongs to you, the people of your great nation. Your military should withdraw from governance and focus on defending the nation from external threats. The United States of America supports a democratic government that represents the full diversity of the Sudanese people.
Only a civilian government can succeed in delivering stability and security and fulfilling your aspirations for freedom, for peace, for justice, declared Secretary Blinken. You can count on the United States to remain by your side until you achieve this goal.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.